The argument today is in cases United States versus Hartley, which is 22-3010, and United States versus Debtor, 22-3044. Council are present and apparently ready to proceed, so we will go ahead with argument. And you'll want to unmute your screen. So we're ready to go. Ms. Gassman.
Good morning. May it please the court, Kayla Gassman for the appellants Dalton Hartley and Corey Debtor. The error in these two cases is the district court's application of its own policy never to grant early termination of probation, despite a statute that gives the court discretion to grant early termination and sets forth factors that the court should consider when making those decisions in individual cases. A failure to exercise discretion is an abuse of discretion, and that's what we have here. I don't actually think there's any real dispute that it would not be permissible for a district court to adopt a policy never to exercise discretion granted by statute. And I think there's two things in these cases that show that that is what the district court did here. First, the language of the court's orders in these two cases, and second, the court's orders in other cases. So I want to turn to the court's specific language in these orders. So when denying the motions to terminate probation, when the court is explaining why, first, he contrasts supervised release, where the court will consider early termination, with probation, where the court will not consider it. And then he concludes, quote, where the principal sentence imposed on a defendant was of probation, the court does not find that a subsequent truncation of that sentence is in the interest of justice, even if, as here, the conduct of the defendant is meritorious.
So, counsel, when you're saying that the court did not exercise its discretion, didn't it exercise its discretion when it referred to the interests of justice?
So the only finding that the court makes as an interest of justice finding is the fact that the sentence was probation. So the only thing the court cites as the basis for denying was the fact that the defendants got probation. That's just a statement of his policy never to grant early termination. And I think whatever the interest of justice means, it can't mean something that would bar relief in every case. And I think it's as we've said in our reply, even when this court has recognized that a district court has broad discretion to make a decision or to make a finding, that discretion still doesn't give the court the authority to adopt a categorical policy never to do something when a statute gives the court the authority to do that. And here, turning back to the interest of justice finding, the language of that is absolute. So what he says is, if the sentence imposed on a defendant, so any defendant, was of probation, then truncation is not in the interest of justice. That's general language. There's nothing specific or individual to any of these, to either of these defendants. The court is citing, again, just the fact that defendants got a sentence of probation. But of course, the fact that you got a sentence of probation and that you have not completed that sentence is what makes someone eligible to file a motion for early termination. And I also want to point to the court's orders in other cases. So we've attached those orders to our briefs. The court has announced this identical policy in at least four other cases that we've been able to find, including every case that I've been able to identify where a motion to terminate probation was filed. And in each order, the court describes the same policy in the same absolute terms. So I think the language the court actually uses and the consistency of the court's announcement of that policy in every case shows that the court does have a policy here never to grant termination of probation. And that is an abuse of discretion.
Counsel, can I get you, though, to speak a little bit more concretely to why you read this as saying never? I mean, it doesn't say never, and it doesn't say I have a blanket policy to never. It doesn't expressly say that. So can you help me understand where you get the I have a policy never?
So I think the specific place, so I think the whole paragraph, so it's at page 53 of the Hartley record, where the court is contrasting supervised release with probation. I think that's one piece of evidence, because the court is saying, I frequently grant or consider early termination in supervised release cases, but here this is probation, so I'm not going to consider it. And then the sentence at the end of that paragraph, the court says, where the principal sentence imposed on a defendant was of probation, and that is just a general description, this sentence is probation, then the court does not find that truncation is in the interest of justice. So the court will not grant termination if the sentence was probation. And then the last part of that phrase is, even if, as here, the conduct of the defendant is meritorious, I read that to mean no exceptions. So if you got probation, then you can't get truncation of that sentence, you can't get termination, and there are no exceptions. So that's the specific language that I think shows the court is saying that he does not do this. I agree, he doesn't say I have a policy, he doesn't say never, but he's saying in this order, in Mr. Dedder's case, in Mr. Hartley's case, and in four other cases, that when you got a sentence of probation, then I do not grant termination.
Counsel, I'd like to ask you about how you understand the reference to the 3553A factors in the statute should be understood. The statute begins by saying the court, after considering the factors set forth in 18 U.S.C. section 3553A, to the extent they're applicable, may terminate a term of probation. Doesn't that suggest a court must consider the factors only when granting early termination of probation?
I don't think so. I think that the statute sets forth three factors that the court should consider when deciding these motions. But in this case, that's not this case. We don't even get there. I mean, I think our position is the district court didn't consider any of the factors. So he didn't consider the conduct of the defendant, he didn't consider the interest of justice, and he didn't consider the 3553A factors, because his only, I guess, finding is that the sentence was probation. That's just his articulation of his policy, his practice, not to grant termination when the sentence was probation. So in terms of exactly what factors, what 3553A factors the court needed to consider, and kind of at what level of depth, that I don't think any of that is presented by this case, because the court didn't even get that far. The court just says, I'm not going to grant these because you got a sentence of probation.
Well, would you agree that a district court under the statute could deny a motion for early termination solely on the defendant's conduct or the interests of justice?
I don't think that has not been presented by this case. I don't think that's the situation that we have. But I think even if the court is.
Well, put a finer point on it, isn't that the government's argument that is exactly what this judge did, was rely on the interest of justice and really nothing else?
But whatever the interest of justice means under the statute, Congress clearly didn't mean that the court could rely on a fact that's present in every case. So Congress has given the court a statute that says you may grant termination of probation after a year in a felony case. So if the court is interpreting the interest of justice to mean because you got probation, then I'm not terminating probation, that's completely contrary to the statute that made termination available to defendants after serving a year of probation. So, you know, again, I agree, the interest of justice is not defined, it's a very broad term, but whatever it means, I think it doesn't grant the district court discretion to completely ignore the statute and his obligation to make, you know, an individualized assessment when deciding whether to grant a motion in each.
Well, often in rulings from the district court, we give the district court considerable leeway. We do not require, as we often say in sentencing cases, really back in the day when we were dealing more fully with guideline cases, we do not require magic words. We do not require the court to walk through 355-3A in detail. we assume that the court knows the statutes and applies the sentencing statutes. So isn't it enough to refer to the interests of justice here?
So here, in this case, it's not. And here's why. I think in those cases, the court is frequently dealing with an absence of explanation, a very brief explanation, a very brief reference to the 3553A. But here we have the district court giving us his explanation. He's stating what his explanation is. And his explanation is, if I gave you probation, I don't grant termination. And that's contrary to the statute. So, you know, the court can have leeway in a case where there is an absence of explanation, but where the court's explanation is actually contrary to law, then I don't think those principles have the same applicability. I do want to talk about our requested remedy. We set forth, you know, the government hasn't taken a position on reassignment to a different judge. We set forth in the brief why we think those standards are met. I just want to briefly reiterate what those standards are. So the two of the three factors, I think, weigh pretty strongly in favor of reassignment here. The first one is whether the judge would reasonably be expected to have substantial difficulty putting out of his mind his previously expressed views. And then the second factor is whether reassignment is advisable to preserve even the appearance of justice. And those are the two factors that we think are met here, because where a court has a longstanding, frequently announced policy never to exercise his discretion under the statute, and that, you know, early termination of probation is never warranted, I think that the judge can reasonably be expected to have difficulty putting that out of his mind when reconsidering these motions.
And, well, if we rule in your favor and say, you know, this is not permissible, this policy, if it is such a policy, and you have to make other or additional findings in these determinations on these motions, surely we can expect the district court to follow the rulings of this court.
So that's not the standard. So the standard is whether the original judge can reasonably be expected to have substantial difficulty putting out of his mind his previously expressed views. So, you know, we don't have to show that the court wouldn't follow the directions of this court. I think what the standard is whether there's a reasonable belief that the court might have substantial difficulty disregarding his previous views. And that's what we think is met here.
Is there anything in the record to indicate that this judge has any bias towards your clients?
No, but these factors are the factors that the court uses to consider in the absence of personal bias. So of course, if there was a personal bias, I think we would be under a different framework. That's not the framework that we're in. The three factors that we're talking about apply in the absence of a claim of personal bias, and we think that those are met. I did want to briefly discuss the appeal waiver issue that arises in Mr. Hartley's case. Mr. Hartley has a plea agreement with an appeal waiver, but Mr. Detter does not have a plea agreement. So the waiver issue would not prevent the court from reaching the merits of the case in Mr. Detter's case. Three principles I think are particularly important when we're talking about the appeal waiver. So first, that waivers are construed narrowly and against the government. Second, that an appeal waiver has to be construed as a whole and not just by discrete phrases. And then lastly, that ambiguities are construed against the government. And if the waiver is ambiguous as to whether it applies here, then it does not apply. And there are four things that I think I want to talk about super quickly about this waiver that I think are very important that show that it does not cover an appeal from a post-sentencing motion to terminate probation. So first is the waiver's first sentence, all of the terms the government references about waiving the right to appeal any matter in connection with the sentence. So what that phrase actually modifies is the sentence to be imposed herein. And as we've set forth in the briefing, in a plea agreement, that language is most naturally read to mean the original sentence imposed at the initial sentencing and memorialized in the judgment. And then there's more aspects of the waiver that show that that is the scope of it. So then the waiver expressly includes appeals of revocation sentences, which is another post-sentencing proceeding pursuant to separate procedures that creates a separate right to appeal. So the waiver is including one expressly revocation appeals, but not saying anything about motions to terminate probation or appeals of those motions indicates the first is covered, but the second isn't. The waiver also invokes 18 U.S.C. 3742, which gives the defendant the right to appeal a final sentence. So by tying the waiver to 3742, the waiver is again indicating to a defendant that what he's waiving is the right to appeal the original sentence. And then last, I think this is particularly important. The waiver has this in other words clarification. And as we've said in the briefing, in other words, it's an idiom. It's a phrase that's intended to mean, you know, it's summarizing or stating more specifically what was said before. And here, this in other words clarification says that in other words, the defendant waives the right to appeal the sentence imposed in this case.
Well, let me just ask you, in terms of what was said before, isn't the government's strongest argument here based on the words any matter in connection with? Any matter is a pretty broad term, isn't it?
Yes, and I think that is their argument. But my point is that the principles are that those terms have to be read narrowly and against the government, and that they have to be read in context. So the waiver goes on after using that fairly broad term to say all of these other things, including revocation sentences, invoking 3742, and clarifying that the defendant waives the right to appeal the sentence imposed in this case. So all of those other aspects of the waiver show that it means the right to appeal the original sentence and revocation sentences, but it doesn't include the right to appeal a post-sentencing motion to terminate probation. And with just one point that, again, if it's ambiguous, then it has to be read against the government, which I think is an important point. And with that, I will reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Brown.
Good morning, Your Honors. First of all, we'd like to point out that here the district court did not abuse its discretion. It actually exercised its discretion. It found that granting the defendant's motion would not be in the interest of justice. That's the statutory factor, as this court knows. The court made that finding upon considering the individual and case-specific circumstances of the defendant's case, which include, number one, the fact that he had not completed probation in his case, which was the sentence imposed, and number two, that his conduct on probation was meritorious. So that those are individual factors that the court considered, case-specific factors. The court exercised its discretion based upon those case-specific factors and found that it was
not. Could you, on that first point, could you clarify, the court found that he hadn't completed probation, but isn't the whole point of the statute that someone's on probation and is asking for early termination? So is that really an individualized determination? It seems to favor Ms. Gassman's argument that that's something that happens in all of these motions.
Well, Your Honor, I guess the court is asking if that is a cognizable reason to deny the motion. And the fact.
No, I think what I'm asking, it isn't that present in every motion.
I would say it has to be present in every motion. Otherwise, the motion wouldn't be filed. So, yes, it's present. Then the question is whether or not that's a cognizable reason to deny a motion. Now, Your Honor, we think that it is, because the statute says may, as Your Honor already pointed out in oral argument with my colleague, the statute says may. So the court is not required to, even if, for example, if the defendant comes to the court and says, hey, I haven't completed my probation yet, but I want to get off probation, 3742 says that you may, or 3564 says that you may terminate my probation. The district court can just say, well, right, the statute says I may terminate it. But, you know, when I look at it, probation is a sentence I gave you, and I don't think it would be in the interest of justice. And just because the statute allows relief, that doesn't mean that the court has to look at that factor and grant relief, or not even consider that factor, not consider the fact that the defendant has not completed his probation. That's why the statute says may. Otherwise, it would say shall. You know, it says may. So our argument sort of is that, okay, the court has a lot of discretion here because of that may. So if he's already on probation, the court can say, look, you haven't completed your probation yet, so statute says I may or may not grant it, I'm not going to grant it. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's not an abuse of discretion. And it's also a cognizable reason not to grant it. So that's sort of our position. So yes, Your Honor, it is a fact in all of these cases, but it's a factor that it's a cognizable factor that the court can look at when deciding whether to grant the motion and exercise the may that's in the statute. And here that's apparently what the district court did.
But the district court always does this, right? I mean, it did it with Mr. Hartley and Mr. Detmer and all these other cases, and says pretty much the same thing. For someone in the shoes of Mr. Hartley and Mr. Detmer, if they come into this judge's court, it's almost as if the statute doesn't exist.
Well, no, it's not as if the statute doesn't exist. It's that the statute exists and the statute has a big fat may in it. The may, the court says, look, the statute has a may in it. You haven't completed your probation. When I give you a sentence of probation, I want it to be completed. And so I'm just going to not grant your motion. Now, the court has alluded to the fact that the court always does this. That's not anything the court has ever said. You know, it is true that the court has ruled similarly in cases with similar facts, as my colleague points out. But even so, the court here looked at the fact that this defendant in this specific case had not completed his probation. Probation was his sentence, and the court saw that as not being in the interest of justice to grant the motion. And the exercise
counsel, did you find any cases where the court had granted a motion for early release?
No, Your Honor, we did not. We do not. We acknowledge the court's language in the order supports the inference that the court thinks that this is how these types of cases should be handled, and that the cases cited by my colleague do show that the court has ruled similarly in cases with similar facts. And, you know, whether we want to call that a policy, we're not in the business of putting words in the court's mouth and saying, oh, the court has a policy. That's the court's job to do that. We're not going to do that.
Well, how does that square with what Congress decided to do when it enacted the statute? Didn't Congress anticipate that a judge, having received a motion, is going to give individualized consideration, which, you know, at the end of the statement by the judge, he's not referring to Mr. Detmer or Mr. Hartley. He's talking about a defendant.
Well, the court did give individualized consideration. The defendant falls into the class of people that the court identified as one where the principal sentence imposed was one of probation. And because the defendant fell into that class, the court found that it's not in the interest of justice to grant a subsequent truncation of that sentence. So it is a case-specific fact. It's also a case-specific fact that the court considered the defendant's conduct and found that it not to be meritorious. Okay, fine. Now, Your Honor, Judge Matheson, you've asked, well, doesn't this sort of circumvent the intent of Congress? The intent of Congress is to give the court discretion. That's why the word may is in there instead of the word shall or instead of the word must. It's may. So the court has very broad discretion. You know, the argument could be made, we haven't made it, that the court doesn't really even need to make any findings. All the factors can be satisfied and the court can still say, nope, statute has a may in it. I'm not going to grant it. And that would be fine under that statute. So the intent of Congress is to give the court the final say in an act within its discretion. And here, that's just what the court did. If I can move on to just another point on this, there's a waiver here. The court made a finding that is obvious in the record that it's not in the interest of justice to grant the motion. Defendant does not challenge that finding in her opening brief. All the defendant says is, oh, this is a policy. And this is enough to make it wrong. It's not true. There's a finding that it's not in the interest of justice to grant this because defendant had not completed his term of probation. The defendant never grapples with the reasoning behind that. She just says, oh, because it's a policy, that can't possibly stand. It's an abuse of discretion. But here we do have an exercise of discretion. There's a finding.
Counsel, you may not agree with the argument that it was a blanket policy, but How is that not a response to your claim that the judge did find an interest of justice reason to deny the motion? Seems like it is a response to that, and it's not a waiver. It's just it seems more that you're disagreeing with the notion that it's a policy argument.
Well, it's presented as error on the basis of the district court's following its alleged policy. That's how the defendant presents the argument, that the error is to follow a policy. That's how the argument is presented. It's not the district court erred in finding that there was a miscarriage of justice. That's not how the defendant presents the argument. And the defendant does not grapple with the fact that these facts and the court's reasons for making that finding, because the defendant had not completed his term of probation, even though his conduct was meritorious, can result in a miscarriage of justice. The defendant never even grapples with that whole finding or the reasoning behind it. It's waived. And this court can affirm on that basis alone.
Do you concede that the court has a policy in these cases?
Okay. Your Honor, we concede that the court has ruled similarly in cases with similar facts. The word policy is sort of a loaded term, and we hate to characterize it this way.
Well, the sentence that I'm looking at in the court's rulings, the court views that differently, and that is when the sentence was probation. The court views that differently than early termination of supervised release where a defendant has already served his full incarceration sentence. So that is arguably the court's view of this specific situation, and therefore he applies the outcome, which is denied. Is that not a policy?
We think that, and I'm not trying to be evasive here, we acknowledge that the court has ruled similarly in cases with similar facts. Whether it's a policy is sort of an irrelevant legal matter, we think. It doesn't really have any bearing here, because the facts here show that the court did rely on case-specific facts to deny the motion, whether there's a policy or not. That's why we argue harmless error.
So you would rather that we look at this as whether or not the court abused its discretion, just in the generic analysis?
Yes, and that's what we argue in our brief. The court relied on case-specific facts to deny the motion. The two case-specific facts were, number one, the defendant had not completed his term of probation, and number two, that his conduct was meritorious. The court found that the meritorious conduct did not outweigh its concern that the defendant had not completed his term of probation. That's why we argue harmless error. Even if there is a policy, even if the court applied it, the court still denied the motion based on case-specific facts. And the court made a finding that the defendant does not contest that that it was not in the interest of justice on these specific facts to deny the motion. Instead, the defendant presents the error as following a policy. The defendant does not present the error as the district court's interest of justice finding was an abuse of discretion. That's basically what our argument is.
How could the defendant's meritorious conduct be a ground to deny the motion?
It's not a ground to deny, but we just point that out to show that the district court considered a case specific factor in denying the motion, and whether or not it supports denial, the court weighed factors and found that factor did not weigh predominantly in the balancing because the defendant had not completed his term of probation. That's all.
Well,
we're saying
you mentioned a class of, I think you used the word class of cases earlier. So if we have a case where the defendant was put on probation, has not completed the term of probation, and whose conduct was meritorious, if we have a class of defendants that meet all of those descriptions, then this judge is going to say, in the interest of justice, motion denied. Is that where we are with this judge?
I think that's fair to say. I think that's fair to say, Your Honor. I think that's fair to say. But then we circle back to my prior argument that the court can consider the fact that the defendant did not complete his term of probation is not a factor that the statute says the court cannot consider. The interest of justice is not defined in the statute. That term is not defined. courts have broad authority to define that term. The court had the authority to look at whether the defendant had completed his term of probation and finding whether he was, should get relief under the statute. The statute's use of the term may tells you everything that you need to know about Congress's intent. The court has broad discretion to grant or not, or broad discretion to grant or not grant these motions. And in the interest of justice, the court has the ability to make that finding. That's our argument. If there are no more questions about that, I will move to the waiver, to the appeal waiver argument in Mr. Hartley's case. All right. On the appeal waiver, we think that the waiver bars this appeal based on the language in the basically the first sentence of the appeal waiver that says the defendant knowingly and voluntarily waives any right to attack any matter in connection with the components of the sentence to be imposed herein. So this is as broad language as you can possibly get. We can't make it any broader. We can't even imagine how we can make it any broader if this court said it was delimiting in any way. The defendant says, oh, well, this doesn't talk about the denial of a motion for early termination of probation. Well, the waiver says any right to appeal, any right to appeal. And that includes any right to appeal that he may have that would come up during this prosecution and sentence. And here we are. He's trying to exercise a right to appeal, which he has, but he's waived any right to appeal. That's really how simple the argument is here.
But it's a sentence imposed, which would lead one to believe we're talking about the sentencing that will occur in this case. And aren't we beyond that in this matter, where we have a motion after sentencing, after service of part of the sentence, which is probation, and then a motion is filed? How do we reach out that far and apply this language to apply to that motion?
Well, the sentence to be imposed, that language, you know, the plea agreement and the waiver is negotiated before the sentence is imposed. If we said the sentence imposed in this case, it wouldn't temporally make sense. So we say the sentence to be imposed. Do we think that there's a limitation by the use of the word the sentence? Does that mean just the original sentence? No. The waiver talks about other types of appeals, collateral attacks, motions to modify, things like that. So, and also a motion, a challenge to a sentence or revocation on supervised release. So there's no temporal limitation in this appeal waiver of what appeal he can bring. He's waived any right to appeal any matter. We can't make it any broader than that.
Couldn't you make it broader by saying the sentence to be imposed and any requests for modification, reduction, early termination of probation? If that had been there, wouldn't you have a stronger position?
You know, it would be stronger, but it would be stronger. Yes, it would be more clear. Yes. But that does not mean that this is inadequate for the purpose that we're saying it's adequate for today. You know, we can make it stronger. I mean, that the language that the court just cited is good language. And you know, we may use that in the future. But here, the language that we have is enough to find that this appeal falls within the scope of the appeal waiver.
Let me just ask you, if we agree that your reading is a reasonable reading, don't we also have to decide that Mr. Hartley's reading is an unreasonable one for you to prevail, given that we read these appeal waivers narrowly?
Oh, I feel like the court's asking a trick question.
Give it a try.
I know. I suppose the court could conclude that the defendant's view is not compelled by the cases and the appeal waiver application principles that he cites. And because his view is not compelled by those principles in those cases, and the government's view makes sense within the context of the appeal waiver, the court can affirm the appeal waiver. that the defendant's view is not compelled by the law. Is it plausible? Is it, can the argument be made? Maybe. Is it compelled by the law that he cites? No, it's not compelled. Our interpretation is reasonable. And even if it's narrowly construed and he's given the benefit of any ambiguities, it's still sufficiently clear. Even when narrowly construed, it still covers this appeal. We can't get any broader than an appeal waiver that waives any right to appeal any matter in connection with the sentence. We just can't do it, but we'll definitely try in the future. I see that my time is up. I'm willing to yield the remainder of my time if the panel doesn't have any more questions.
Thank you, counsel. We have some reserved rebuttal time.
I want to make a few points. So I think I essentially heard the government concede this district court does have a policy, has a policy, a practice, a rule, whatever you call it. This court has a consistent view that early termination will not be granted in probation cases. I think that's the error. That's what the cases say. That's what this court's opinion in Vargas says. The other cases that we've cited in our brief, the government emphasis on may is I think essentially beside the point. Of course, the district court has broad discretion under the statute, but this court has said in other cases, other courts have said the existence of discretion does not give a district court authority to adopt a policy never to exercise that discretion when Congress has set forth factors and provided the district court with discretion to make a decision. The court still has to actually exercise that discretion. And the court here instead adopted his own blanket policy outside the statute never to do this. The suggestion that the district court made an individualized interest of justice finding and that we haven't challenged that, I just don't see that in this court's order. The only finding that I see is that the sentence imposed was of probation. I don't see any language in this order relying even on the fact that the full term hasn't been served. But even if there is, as we've set forth in our reply, and as I think Judge Matheson, some of your questions acknowledged, that just means the fact that a defendant hasn't served the full term just means he's eligible to file a motion. And I do think that defendants come into this district court as if 3564 does not exist. The statute gives the defendants an opportunity to file a motion to terminate probation early at the specified time in the statute. So the district courts are obligated to consider individualized factors and make individualized decisions when making those decisions. And here, the district court simply does not do that. On the appeal waiver, again, I just want to reiterate that the government's argument about focusing on, you know, the right to appeal any matter in connection with focuses on discrete phrases, interprets them as broadly as possible, and interprets them out of context, which is all completely contrary to how this court says appeal waivers should be interpreted. The court can't look at the first sentence and not the rest of the waiver. The rest of the waiver applies to revocation sentences, expressly covers revocation sentences. If the government's interpretation was the only reasonable one, there would be no reason that for the appeal waiver to then also expressly include revocation sentences. The waiver invokes 3742, which is the right to appeal the original sentence in specified circumstances. The waiver goes on to, with that in other words clarification, to summarize that the right that's being waived is the right to appeal the original sentence. Now, of course, there's other language in this waiver about the collateral attack, about other things that are not at issue because the government has conceded that they're not at issue. So yes, those things are waived. But the specific question in this case is whether this waiver covers the right to appeal a motion to terminate probation when that is not mentioned. And there are several aspects of this waiver that indicate that what the appeal waiver covers is the right to appeal the original sentence as well as the other things that are expressly covered, which is not a motion to terminate probation. And again, if the waiver is ambiguous, if the government's reading is reasonable, but it's not the only reasonable interpretation, then the waiver must be interpreted in favor of Mr. Hartley's appellate rights.
Thank you, counsel. You ended right on the nose there. That will conclude the arguments this morning. We appreciate the arguments of counsel. They are very helpful. The case will be submitted.